This is Anthony Pascal.
And this is Laurie Elster, and this is a bonus supplemental episode of the All Access Star Trek podcast. Today we want to talk about the Pancan Purple Stride Walk that's coming up, and we have some amazing guests to do that with. We have Armin Shimerman and Kitty Swink.
Hello.
Hi.
We have Jonathan Frakes.
Good day.
We have Juan Carlos Cotto, brother of Manny Cotto.
But you knew I was going to say that, right? I'm so predictable.
Hola. And we will have John Billingsley at some point. He is busy working on a secret project at a secret location. But then he is going to...
It's about a country lawyer. A crusty but benign country lawyer.
I will never tell you anything about me ever again.
And why would you ever have?
He plays a curmudgeonly doctor.
Yeah. He's a vuncular.
He is a vuncular.
All right. Well, we have a lot to talk about. We're going to talk about the Pancan Walk. We're going to talk about Star Trek because that's what we do. But let's start with the Purple Stride Walk, which is happening on Saturday, April 27th. We need people to donate. We need people to participate. So if you guys could tell us all the details, that would be great.
Well, usually we start with Jonathan Frakes telling us about how he got connected to this organization.
We want to go there. Do we want to start there? Let's push the Pancan Walk.
It's their biggest event. Right?
60 cities across the country.
Maybe we should first say what Pancan is. Regular listeners will remember we did an episode with Jonathan last year, but it is the biggest charity that is trying to find a cure for pancreatic cancer, which is one of the worst killer cancers out there.
The second most lethal cancer in the pantheon.
In the United States, yeah.
And each of our guests here has a personal connection to how this disease has affected their families and their lives. And they're all rallying together for a kind of Star Trek-themed group for the big Pancan Purple Stride Walk coming up on April 27th. And they're trying to break a new record for fundraising to help cure pancreatic cancer.
And not just for fundraising. We want people, because there are 60 cities, as Jonathan just said, around the country, we want people to participate in the walk. We want people to be educated in what Pancan is trying to do. By the way, it's called Pancan, but it's the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network. And we want people to be informed because, yes, all of us have been touched, and unfortunately, lots of people have been touched.
Yep.
Give us the proper name of the website.
The proper name for the website is www.purplestride.org/Team Trek.
Look at that. He highlighted it.
I had nothing to do today except memorize that one line.
Went to the gym.
And you did a great job.
Thank you. You can buy me a drink.
I'd be more than happy. So we're gathering in LA at Santa Monica Pier at about 8 o'clock on Saturday morning, the 27th. You're welcome to join us.
8:30.
Oh, 8 for us, 9 for you.
Yeah.
Then the speeches start at 9:30, and then we take a walk.
Right. Purple is encouraged. A hat is encouraged. Sunscreen's encouraged.
John Billingsley says, "So sorry, not going to make the phone conversation." Bummer.
Oh.
Fooey.
I object.
I'll yell at him later.
I'll say there's some
objection. You're out of order. The prosecution is not going to get that man today.
You don't suppose he's asking for extra takes, do you?
Yeah, exactly. I need another one.
Can I just try something?
He's probably getting overtime, so that's good.
Your Honor, this is a travesty. It's the travesty of a mockery of a sham. Sorry, I'm just quoting all legal.
I like legalese. Yes. It's legalese. My friend Kitty tells me via text, that we have quite a mob joining us. Is that the word you used?
We do. We have a mob. We have a huge group of people. We have the Cotto family in toto, I think.
Hey.
Oh.
Just came to me.
A lot of Kodos.
We have a gazillion Kodo crew. We have one of my friends who took care of me when I was sick 20 years ago, one of my girlfriends, left the show business world, God bless her, moved to Chicago, and she and her son and daughter are flying out because she had pancreatic cancer last year and she's in complete remission.
Wow, so right.
And a bunch of those girlfriends are going to show up and walk with us. And our friend Greg Cope White, who's a showrunner. And we have another one of my girlfriends from a different group of women that's more recent in my life, who currently is battling stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And she's in a trial at MD Anderson, but she's going to fly back. And that group of women are going to walk. So, and then we have a bunch of Star Trek fans and us. So it'll be great.
I would venture from my experience in past walks in Santa Monica for Purple Stride, we had about 10,000 people. When I walked in Kansas City, I would say the number was less, but not much. There was about 7,000 people. So one can imagine that there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people walking on the 27th for pancreatic cancer. And God bless them all.
Yep.
Now, you don't have to walk to contribute to the event.
You do. And you don't have to contribute. You can walk.
Or you can contribute and walk, or you can put it on your social media and say, help these folks.
Because just raise awareness.
Yeah, it's not just about saving lives, which it is, but it's also about helping families and talking about nutrition and giving them support and helping people get into clinical trials and all kinds of wonderful things.
One of the things I've been learning about, because I've watched you guys, you know, show up on other people's podcasts and do interviews, is that the warning signs of this are not always what you would think they might be.
That's right.
And so maybe you could, Lori.
That's a great start. Yeah.
Because doctors often think it's something else. Sorry, Johnny.
But, no, you go.
Doctors often think it's something else, but some of the symptoms are abdominal bloating, digestive problems, jaundice, unexpected weight loss, blood clots, sudden onset diabetes. The doctors think it's something else because they don't think pancreatic cancer.
Back pain.
So back pain, exactly. And so what we're trying to do here is not only educate patients, but also educate doctors.
And one of the things we're encouraging is that you go to our pancreatic cancer website and find an alternative doctor, which they will certainly provide for you, so you can get a second opinion if you don't think you're getting the straight poop from your doctor, or it's a doctor who's not as educated as they might be in this area, which a lot of them aren't, or if you have a relative who has exhibited or suffered with, you need to alert your doctor at your annual checkup, because one of the specifics that we're raising money for is to find a simpler blood test as a marker that we could get to this thing sooner. My brother died because he was so yellow when we took him in. The guy opened him up and did the Whipple, which is what the operation is called. They said, there's nothing we can do. He has 6 months to live. 5 months later, he was gone. And the same thing happened with Billingsley's mother. I'm sure he would tell you that story. It is a brutal, brutal disease, and it's often caught so late. And that's why Kitty, who we adore, is our vision of hope as a 20-year survivor. Kodo still has a hardwired telephone in his house.
I got calls coming in. I don't know. I feel like I'm at the newsroom. Copy. For Manny, it was sudden onset diabetes. It was 2 years ago. He was super thirsty. He could not quench his thirst. His wife said, you know, my dad had diabetes. I think it might be diabetes. He went in and checked it out. They realized he was too young to have this kind of onset diabetes. He had really no history of it, and there was no history in the family. And they decided to look further, thank God, and they found it early-ish, and he was able to sort of put up a fight for a year. They found a tumor in the duct of the pancreas, which was interfering, and that's what was giving him the diabetes. It was a different disease that led them to the pancreatic cancer. And he did 2 rounds of chemo and radiation, and was all set for the Whipple, but it had spread, so he wasn't able to have surgery. But he was able to put up more of a fight, I think, because they found it early and they diagnosed it early. But it's what's amazing is how many people you just Kitty, just in talking about all the people in her life, there's so many people, whenever I would tell them the news, who had had someone in their life who was affected by pancreatic cancer. And so it's out there, and we just want to raise awareness so people can catch it early and be able to fight.
Exactly. When Daniel was diagnosed, I believe there was a 3% survival rate. Kitty, I believe it was 4%. And Armin tells us and reminds us with great pride that we're now at 13%, which is completely unacceptable, but three times what it has been. So we're certainly moving in the right direction.
Go ahead.
And the expectation is that what PanCAN's expectation is that by 2030, it'll be up to 20%. Still not good enough, but at least exponentially better.
And there's breaking news this week about a new blood test that may change things. So that's very exciting. That's very exciting.
A blood marker, a marker that will say, okay, there's that. Now we know that this is the reason why you have these symptoms.
Yeah.
Instead of wondering about other things, they go directly to pancreatic cancer.
I mean, they take my tumor markers every year and it goes up and down, and it doesn't, you know, when I was diagnosed, they discovered it was a gazillion numbers high, but they don't use it because it's not very good. It's not a very good marker. I mean, it's okay, but it's not like getting a mammogram, which is such an easy thing, which is how they found out I had breast cancer 10 years before my pancreatic cancer, because I'm an overachiever. I tried to do it twice.
Yeah.
So,
for those of you, I know Johnny and Armin and Kitty have been involved with PanCAN for years now. You're not just seeing a raising of awareness of this disease through your work, but actual tangible improvements in testing and curing the disease as well?
Yes.
Not so much in curing, but in finding out ahead of time, because someone mentioned this, the sooner you find out about the diet, that there's a possibility, it's easier to cure it. When you're diagnosed at the end of your disease, it's very hard to save people. But the sooner you can look at the symptoms and diagnose it, then there's a possibility, a very good possibility, that you can be relieved of this.
That's not to say PanCAN hasn't been instrumental in funding a lot of new research in new drugs and other new ways to save people's lives, and also getting people to the right
clinics.
Well, yeah. So my friend who's in one of the trials at MD Anderson, one of the ways she knew about this trial to get into it was through PanCAN. So that makes a big difference. If you get into a new trial and it's a life changer, hallelujah.
And the thing about cancer is they're all different, of course. All the cancers are different. But research into one cancer helps into research of other cancers.
Yeah. I like the story about the pancreatic cancer being part of eliminating people's need to stay in those false trials.
Yeah.
Explain that to me again.
So PanCAN went to FDA and said, people are stuck in trials and they know that it's not working on them and you're not letting them out so they can go do another trial. And they got all of the cancer organizations together and they lobbied the FDA and the NIH, and that changed. That's changed. So now if you're in a trial that's not working for you, because pancreatic cancer, there's lots of different forms of pancreatic cancer, lots of different genetic makeup of it. So let's get you out of a trial that's clearly not saving your life, and let's get you into another one. And I have to say, the leaders of this organization, Julie Fleischman and Pam Marquardt, who started the organization, Pam started the organization, and Julie
25 years ago.
Yeah, 25 years ago, because her mother died. These people have been instrumental and on the cutting edge of changing how all cancer is attacked, because they're getting people to talk to each other. You know, it used to be that this organization's quietly holding their information and that organization's quietly holding theirs. And if we all work together, we get more stuff done and patients have better outcomes and families have better outcomes. Cause it's not just about patients like me, but it's about Jonathan and Juan Carlos and Johnny and Armin and what happens to them.
Yeah. I mean, having them as a resource is immeasurable. You know, it really is about the fact that they do take action for you, as Armin mentioned earlier, and Jonathan, that, you know, they'll help you find a better doctor, but they also are just a resource for anything you might be facing, for family, you know, for the patients themselves. And that's part of what we're trying to do is get people to be aware of this. Because as I said, everyone's affected by it or been affected by it. So if you're out there and you have a relative and you've heard, just look it up, Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, and get them connected to your family so that they can benefit from everything this organization has to offer.
And Kitty, frankly, has worked tirelessly helping people understand and listening to people. It's my impression of the organization is that it's just, or if nothing, it's more valuable perhaps to the family than to the patient.
Yeah.
And that seems to be often the case.
One of the things they do, which I love, and they've been sort of touting it on social media this week, is if you're in treatment, they have survivors that are volunteers that you can talk to. Yeah. I talk to people all the time, but I'm sort of a semi-public figure. But they hook you up with people who are volunteers who have survived and can help you get through the process. I mean, that's an extraordinary gift to somebody.
There can't be anything more terrifying than being diagnosed with cancer. You want to talk to people who've gone through it so you know their stories. You can hear their hopes. You can hear their stories. You can look forward. You can make plans. If you're all by yourself, it's got to be terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also what you guys said about having doctors that you can go to. I mean, there are groups like traditionally women go to doctors and what we say is very easily dismissed by doctors. Oh, yeah, you know, it's just a woman thing or whatever it is. And so the idea that you can find doctors that have been vetted is really important.
Yeah, not just vetted, but that are expert in this disease.
Right.
Is there much of a genetic or hereditary component to this? Like you talked a lot about families. If someone, if their parent or uncle had this, does that make them more likely?
I think 10%, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is enough that you should certainly alert your doctor to it.
Go, Jonathan, go.
No, that's it. 10% is what I've been told, which I think is a massive number, put in the light of if that possibility is 1 in 10, then you certainly need to tell your doctor and you need to get tested specifically for it.
If you have the BRCA mutation, which is also linked to breast cancer and ovarian cancer, particularly it might be something you should look into, but there's other mutations that you should be, if you have a first stage relative, like a brother or a sister or a parent, particularly for that, you should have genetic testing. Yeah.
Right. And PanCAN is, helping out with all of that as well. It sounds
It is. Yeah. It will direct you to the right doctors. It's a national organization. You may live in a state that doesn't have a lot of doctors who know about this, but they will point you to whatever doctor is in your area so that you can go there. You may have to drive a little further, but at least it'll be somebody who's knowledgeable and an expert.
Right.
One thing you guys have done is you've really rallied the Star Trek community, which is a huge community of people who are often looking for ways to unite and do some good, especially as the world is getting crazier and crazier. Mm-hmm. And have you found that that's like been growing and growing since you really pulled together as a group?
Yeah, I think it's not only since we've pulled together as a group, I think the awareness has gone up around ALS because of Kenny Mitchell. Mm-hmm. And I think that John's organization, where he's the Hollywood Food Coalition, has the crossover has been massive for us. And I just think awareness in general of people helping other people, which is obviously one of our great Roddenberry-esque themes, as Pollyanna as it may sound, has really paid off for us.
Yeah.
And it's about science as well.
Yeah.
There's a great swath of our country that doesn't believe in science. I don't understand it. But we are talking about science. We are talking about how science does help. And you can't have help unless you have research. And research just takes people who are knowledgeable doing the science.
Yeah. I'm just going to tell you a weird story. We were on the Star Trek cruise a couple months ago. And we one night had a cocktail with a couple that were really nice. We had a lovely chat with them. They were big supporters of a different health organization. And they heard my story. And they just, the next thing I know, they donated $1,000. They just out of the blue, without me asking, without seeing they just heard the story. And they said, we want to help you guys. I don't, and there's people who give us $5 who for them, $5 is the same as for those people, $1,000. And that's because Star Trek fans are generous. They're kind. They believe in the future. They believe in hope, which is sort of my job, I think, as a survivor, is to give people hope. I think it's amazing to ask Juan Carlos, would you tell the story about how Manny was as a kid and how he was attracted to this group, this show? And because I just think it's extraordinary.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, we grew up in Orlando, Florida. Our parents had come from Cuba. Manny found the show on, he actually tells the story that my parents watched it. And when he first saw it, he didn't quite get it. Right. And then he was too little. And then he caught it in reruns, and it was on the UHF channel, channel 35. And he started watching it and became obsessed with it to the point where, you know, back then you had to kind of wait. You had to watch the TV guide to know what order the episodes were coming in. So, he'd like work his way up to the doomsday machine. You know, he just like was always waiting for the next favorite episode. But, you know, Star Trek is about people who are reaching for the stars, you know, and what better aspiration can you have than that? And it was so overwhelming for him that it became, you know, his defining creative force as a young filmmaker. You know, he just stole my dad's Super 8, and then he, you know, sort of gave me the bug by default, right? I just sort of picked up the camera right after him, and I was sort of the PA on his films, and then after that started doing it myself. And it was always a dream of his to work on Star Trek, and he came out to LA in 1983. He worked on all kinds of things, and when he got Enterprise, it was, you know, just a lifelong dream come true. And he was on it for those two seasons, and it was full circle for him. And so when he was facing this diagnosis and sort of fighting against it, you know, toward the end of it, I became aware of the Star Trek connection. I didn't know, because it was an outpouring for him. And in that outpouring, I'm still so overwhelmed by all of the love from the Trek fans that I just, you know, I had to help however I could. You know, I've been a fan myself my whole life, but, you know, I got the bug from him. So it was just, it just seems so right, you know, that, and the science part of it too, Armin. I mean, it's so true, you know, that, those two things go together, you know, looking toward the future. And I'm just hoping I can honor his memory and really honor Star Trek by doing this, you know.
And you have, and you will.
Thank you.
I mean, I was also one of those kids combing through TV Guide and marking which one was coming up and which ones that I was missing. And Armin, I know you also were an original series fan. And Kitty, I think you were.
Oh, also? I was an original. My oldest brother grew up to be a rocket scientist because of Star Trek. So he was going to be a scientist, I grew up on it. Yeah.
I was a huge fan of the original show, and I did all I could to become a Ferengi. I know that's a bizarre sort of statement. And when they were kind enough to offer me the role, and I hadn't accepted it yet, I marched myself to my friend Jonathan Frakes' trailer.
I was hoping you'd go to that story.
I said, Johnny, I really would like to do this, but it is daunting to wear that makeup. And he talked to me for about 20 minutes and convinced me that I should do it. So I'm sitting here because of Jonathan Frakes.
You're talking about your season one Next Gen episode.
No, this is when
Quark was going to be a regular on Deep Space.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So for you to come back and do it as a regular.
I wouldn't say come back, but to come back as something slightly different that I wanted to do. I apologize for that first season.
I do too. Collectively we do.
Horrible, horrible.
I think it was the lack of having a beard. I think the fact that the beard was missing in the first season was a big part of it.
Absolutely.
For sure.
You are a meme.
Yeah. No, you're a trope. It's like a trope. Now it's an expression. I mean, it's a TV expression. Riker's beard.
Armin, since your time on DS9, every once in a while there'll be a Ferengi character on another show,
right?
Even some of the new shows, there's a, I don't know if you've heard that, like Discovery has a bar now and there's a Ferengi bartender.
I told him,
and a Lurian sitting at the bar,
right? So do you ever get any calls, anyone you need advice from you? Because I know
they early on in the Berman years they would send them what I had done on Next Generation as to say, this is what a Ferengli is like. And unfortunately, they sent him that work to all the people who played Ferengli. So they had to follow in those horrible footsteps. It was my agenda to change those footsteps on Deep Space Nine, which I tried to do. But speaking of other performers, I don't know his name, but kudos to the gentleman in Picard who played a Ferengi.
Aaron Stanford.
Thank you.
That was Aaron Stanford, who's a friend of mine. Aaron Stanford, I worked with him on Nikita. Well, and he worked with Terry Matalas on Nikita. And Terry brought him on, and he was the star of 12 Monkeys.
Oh.
And he's fantastic. And it was a daunting thing for him to do, but he did a great job. Yeah.
He did more than a great job. When I saw the performance, I turned to Kitty after the scene was over and I said, that's the way I should have done it.
He's a great actor. You know, he's fantastic. And there's Brian Helgeland, who was Manny's writing partner and a dear friend. And if you want to read a really great essay about Manny, Google Brian Helgeland. And on Deadline, he did an appreciation after Manny passed. But Brian did a movie called Finest Kind that's on Paramount Plus. And it's based on his not childhood, but on his teens and 20s. Before he became a screenwriter, he was a scallop fisherman in New Bedford, Massachusetts, right?
Wow.
But there's one of the fishermen is played by Aaron Stanford, and he's unbelievable in it. He's just great. So it's worth watching as well. Aaron's fantastic. Yeah. I'm glad you liked it. I'm going to let him know.
In awe of it.
Yeah.
I thought it was just astounding. I was just astounding.
Tell him the Dorney story.
So before they cast me, Dorn called me up and said, oh, I'm doing an episode of, Picard, where I kill off a Ferengi. Wouldn't it be great if it were you? I said, Michael, no, it would not be great. And I told him just to forget about that idea altogether.
He wanted to cut your head off.
That
was brutal.
Yeah, that was. Yeah. It was brutal. And I got to say, for all the times I've baked bread for Michael Dorn, that was really a shitty thing for him to say.
I'm not sure he knew he was going to cut his head off.
I mean, well, he knew he was going to
think that was a Ferengi.
He knew that. He knew that because that's what he said to me.
He was great, but that Ferengi was based on your Ferengi, and the tightrope you walked, all levity aside, to represent what Roddenberry thought is this despicable capitalist pig with huge ears, and yet be humorous, smart, charming. Clever, all the qualities that Quark had, and still be essentially a villain. You know, it was a very, very, it was, and do it through rubber. It takes a special actor, which you
are. Thank you, Johnny. That's true. It's very sweet.
I did notice with the Ferengi bartender on Discovery that the pouring had already begun. And I remembered you saying, Armin, that pouring the drinks was hard because you couldn't see what you were actually doing. And I was like, oh, they must have figured that out. And they're like, let's put the bottle in the glass.
Yeah, we lined them up with it already in place. That was he was no Armin. But then again, Discovery's no Deep Throat Nine either. So let's be honest.
Are you watching and I guess the same question for you, Juan, is are you watching the new shows as Star Trek fans?
Picard I watched, and Strange New Worlds I've watched. I'm not caught up, but I have. Discovery I watched the first couple seasons.
Season five I've been so swamped
with 9-1-1. I've been so swamped because we did a half season and we started late and it's been kind of busy.
Discovery season five is it. I've seen people say this, and I'm curious if you feel the same way, Johnny. Some people have described season five of Discovery as a lot like season four of Enterprise, where they kind of, which was Manny's season, where they're kind of finally figuring out how to do it right as they're being canceled.
We didn't know we were being canceled. I call it we. They didn't know. I did the first half of the finale of Discovery Season 5, and the marching orders were that they were going to be, you know, like they were all Harrison Ford at this point.
Right.
That was after the long, emotionally draining stories that they had lived through. and the tone of the season five is astounding. But nobody knew until Tunde and I sort of did the last episode together, and then the show was canceled, and then they wrote new scenes, which I'm sure you've heard, and Tunde had to go back up, and they, you know, wrapped up the, unlike some shows which are canceled, and they didn't have a chance to, but.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know. Yeah.
I'm sure Manny, you know, he was asked many times about like what, because he had plans for you know keeping on going on that. That must have been really hard for him.
Yeah,
I think it was really hard for him to see Riker and Troy on his show at the end. I know that for a fact.
Everyone's still talking about that,
and he wasn't alone.
Everyone's speculating that's the extra thing they filmed for Discovery.
They asked him, Marina said no.
Oh my god.
If I remember correctly, Manny said that in his mind the previous episode was the season was the series finale.
Yes, I think that was his generously as you could put it.
So I don't want to misquote him, but I think so, yes.
And Tripp's still alive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, he loved Tripp because Tripp was the focus of his first episode, right? So,
also,
one Carlos, did you ever pitch to Rick or ever try to get on the old shows or the new shows?
Yeah. When I was when I was starting out, I pitched Deep Space Nine. I pitched Renee and I pitched fellow Cubano Renee Echevarria and Robert Hewitt Wolf. I pitched them actually a Mirror episode really early on. I don't remember exactly what the story was, but it was a Mirror episode. It was something happened with the power source of the space station, and it opened up the thing. And they ended up doing Mirror stuff anyway, right?
We did three Mirror episodes on Deep Space Nine, in which they killed off a Ferengi in each one of them. Yeah,
they did.
Right. I just thought it was a cool thing to do because I had always, you know, I just thought it was cool. Deep Space Nine was tricky because it kind of like. You know, they ended up putting a ship on the show, but for me, it was like the narrative. It should have been serialized. That was always my thing about Deep Space Nine. I mean, Deep Space Nine is awesome, and it found its way and whatever. But I always thought that at the beginning, it should have been more like an ER where the stories, if the place doesn't move, the story should move, was my theory, right? But they resisted serialization in every show. I don't know if you guys remember, but.
Oh, we remember.
It was always about, you remember, it was always about standalone stuff. So it's like, well, we got to have a ship then. And so we'll have a ship and we'll go out on stuff and come back to the base, right?
Right.
It's because we were syndicated, in my opinion anyway, because it was syndicated and we didn't, the syndication networks didn't want to have a long story. But eventually we became one of the first people to do long story form.
Yeah.
Where some of our stories went on for five, six,
well, the
seven.
War and stuff and everything in the last seasons is, you know, just it kind of. And in my mind, that's, you know, it found its voice in that way, right? It's like,
I think those are the best.
I've always wanted to do that also I've just always thought it would be great to do Casablanca in this universe, you know? I mean, I think it's partly my heritage being Havana, which is, you know, a city that I've been obsessed with my whole life for obvious reasons. You know, Havana is this city that was sort of a nexus point between the old and the new world, right? And everybody passed through there, right? Mm-hmm. And you do that in a Star Trek or a Star Wars universe and tell the story of a club or a place where everybody, the stories pass through it, right? So you can just do everything, right?
I think we have a Quark's Bar series right there.
There you go.
I'm just saying, JC.
It would be great.
I don't know if you guys probably don't follow the minutiae of Star Trek news, but a big topic this week is something that came from an interview with Alex Kurtzman, who's in charge of Star Trek. And he was talking about old Star Trek versus new Star Trek and how, like in the old days of syndication, they would shoot for 100 episodes and they would do dozens of episodes each year. And he said, like, he talked to old writers about what he'd called filler episodes, but that now they only do 10 episodes a season. So they try, you know, they can't really do that. They try to make each one count. So, you know, Jonathan and, you know, Armin and, you know, anyone, you know, weigh in, but when you were there on the front line, did you ever realize like this is just a filler episode? Like, no, you know, or do you never know which ones are the good ones and the ones that are going to pop? versus this, you know, and what do you even think of this notion that there is maybe one man's filler is another man's favorite episode?
Yeah, I think that's the case.
I think that is the case.
Go ahead. I'll
Go ahead first.
Yeah, you go. You have a better idea. The only filler episode that I thought was real was the one in which they clearly did a clip show, which I don't remember the name of, where I was having brain surgery.
Shades of Gray.
And that was a piece of shit.
Yeah. Right.
But it was.
Yeah, we had stuff called.
Filler episodes are never intentional.
No, of course they're never intentional.
You don't sit there and look at your schedule and go, let's make these three filler episodes. But you often get caught in a situation where you either have run out of money or you need to save your money for the big battle at the end. You know, you can't do best of both worlds on a shoestring budget. You know, you got to hoard your apples in the middle of the season. Right. So TV seasons as producers, it's a bell curve. Right. You blow a bunch of money at the beginning and then in the middle, there's a lot of talking.
Sometimes those are the best episodes.
Dramatic discussions, right?
Yeah.
But out of that comes great shit, right? I mean, look at Inner Light. Look at Inner Light, right? Look at the Menagerie Part 1 and 2, which is like the busted pilot. It's like, who had that idea? Let's take the old pilot and recut it and retell the whole story in a different way and put a trial around it, which is super cheap, right?
It's a bunch of the same thing happened with Measure of a Man.
Yeah.
What's the episode with Harris Yulin?
That's Duet, which was a bottle show where you just basically had two actors talking all the time, but you had two wonderful actors, Harris Yulin and Nana Visitor. And that's a bottle show that was that's Johnny's Riot, or that wanted to save money. JC's right. And that's one of the most phenomenal episodes we ever did. And it's just two people talking.
Yep. But Anthony, I'm sure you know this. The show Next Gen was the first scripted drama that was made directly for syndication. So it wasn't syndicated afterwards the way most shows had been up to that point, where they had 100 episodes and somebody bought it. So our show and the people at Paramount sold it to 237 separate channels. They sold it with half of the advertising attached. We made 26 episodes a year. They had a set budget for the year, and you split it up 26 ways or however they saw fit. And exactly what Juan Carlos said is true, that you got to save stuff for the cliffhanger, because that time, like your example is perfect, best of both worlds. Picard's off, he's Locutus, you know. We're about to blow up the ship and fucking leave. We're going to kill him and leave him.
Yeah. And they would have all been standing on the bridge going, hey, that's a big cube. That cube's pretty big, isn't it? Wow, that's huge. Right? It's like, you got to have the dough, man.
But but people had to wait all summer to find out what happened. You know, that's a case.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a very long summer.
Oh, my God. That was the longest summer for me since Who Shot J.R.?
Yeah, that was a big deal. Mr. Warren
was like, Who Shot J.R., right?
Wow.
Fire.
Who Shot J.R.?
Yeah. Armin, I've been really enjoying watching you on Delta Flyers. You guys just did Duet this week, which just came out. I love your insights, and I love watching Robbie and Garrett reacting to the show, which they've never seen before, which is really fun. But are you, I know you've watched it, but are you discovering new things in the show as you're rewatching it with them?
Absolutely. One of the things I'm discovering, and it's a terrible thing for me to say, but it's absolutely true. I'm discovering how phenomenally good some of the actors that I worked with on a regular basis, I'm going, that's really a really good performance. I thought they were good actors, but sometimes they're doing extraordinary work. And I was not aware of that before, probably out of my own ego. You know, I was probably only looking at myself in the scenes I was in. But I am incredibly impressed with Sirach Lofton, who plays Jake. I am enormously impressed with Terry Farrell, and I'm very, very much impressed with Avery Brooks.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been fun rewatching along with you guys. Kitty, are you going to do any of the Delta Flyers episodes when your Deep Space Nine's come up?
I don't know. I guess if Robbie and Garrett ask me, I'll do it. Yeah.
I'm sure the ones that Kitty's in, there's two episodes that Kitty's in from Deep Space Nine that she will be invited to talk on those.
You know.
They better.
The best part about the second one was that one of my oldest friends killed me. That was. Oh, good. Andy Robinson will be dead.
You'll notice they never allowed Kitty and I to work together on Deep Space Nine.
We have worked together on my favorite.
We have worked for Johnny together.
Yeah,
yes.
But my favorite is we did a movie that shall remain nameless that I went into audition and the casting director said as I was walking out the door, say hi to Armin. And the director turned to him and said, Armin Shimmerman, turned to the casting director, Armin Shimmerman. And she said, yes. The next thing I know, they hire him to play my husband and want to pay him more money. And I was like, wait a minute, I got the
job. I got him the job.
I mean, at least the money's all going to the same place, right?
Yeah, there you go.
No, I didn't share it with her. Why would I do that?
Jonathan, I was thinking Armin got to play the mirror version of himself, as Juan was talking about the mirror, but who died, as noted.
Oh, you're thinking about Thomas Riker.
Well, but that's what I'm thinking. You never got to go full evil, though. Like, did you ever wish that you had that chance to?
I did. I always loved the mirror universe. I was involved with the
goatee. Goatee, man.
I could have gone goatee.
That's right.
I thought some of the best stuff on Discovery was when they were playing the.
Like a goatee.
Well, that's how Spock did it, right?
I could have just gone with a porn stash and nothing. That would have been interesting.
Yeah.
Didn't you direct one of the mirror episodes?
I did. I loved the mirror universe on Discovery because of Michelle Yeoh and Captain Killy, Mary Wiseman. And what I didn't understand until I was involved in it is that the mirror characters were either miles apart from each other, depending on their psychic or their some part of their personality, or in the case of what's his name? Who did Anthony Rapp play?
Stamets.
Yes, Stamets. Those characters are very similar.
Yeah.
To Armin's point, you realize when you're watching these wonderful actors who you're working with all the time, if you go back and watch the show, God, they really were good. And I think a lot of it was because everybody's machines, I mean, they did 26, as we used to do.
Yeah.
Even the shitty episodes were good because people were quick and they'd... Even though we were never allowed to ad lib or to change a fucking word, but it was a
not a word, not a syllable, nothing.
Not a syllable. Oh, no.
Really?
Well, but how much ad libbing are you letting happen when you're directing Discovery?
Well, Discovery is one thing, but when we brought Tony Newsom and Jack Quaid into the crossover episode of Strange New Worlds, where we had the characters from Lower Decks who are animated and who Mike McMahon encourages to ad lib. In the middle of one of the early scenes, Tawny and Jack both ad-libbed, and I looked to Bill Wilkoff and Kat Lynn, the writers who were with me on the set, and we smiled, and we thought, I said, are you guys cool? And they said, we sure are. And then
that's amazing.
The floodgates opened, and Hanson, who's a wonderful comedian, Ethan, Rebecca, they all took off, and the show, and, you know, and as a writer, a good ad-lib is your line.
I always say, I can't wait to take credit for it.
Yeah, that's exactly
so on set because it's like, yeah, man, it's a team sport.
Yeah. And when it's good, it's thank you. That's great. And when it's bad, you just don't use it.
Yeah.
And you cut it out. Yeah. You cut it out. Yeah.
In 7 years, did you get a single ad lib in, Armin?
Oh, no. Not in words, no. Not in words. Reactions, yes. But no, if it wasn't DLP, if it wasn't Dead Letter Perfect.
Yeah.
The director said we got to do this again. Judy, our script coordinator, you got to do it again. We had to abide by those rules. Some of the others, now you're talking to the Ferengi, it's possible I was the only one, but some of the others, maybe Avery had the ability to do that, maybe Nana did, but not I.
And also, if you'd like do a David Kelly show, that's another place you have to say the commas where they're written.
Right. Aaron Sorkin, the same deal, I'm told.
Yeah.
Whereas on the modern Trek shows, they have a writer on the set usually.
Oh yeah,
Which was verboten in the Berman years. We didn't know who our writers were for the first 3 years. For the first 3 years, we had no idea who the writers were.
We were at a wrap party, season three.
It was a Christmas party.
Christmas party. We were at this party, and Ira gets all the writers up, and asks the actors if they can name them.
No pressure.
No, that's great.
Lemon can name like two, and
no, I couldn't.
Yeah, you got two.
He's like, that's F. Scott Fitzgerald, and that's Ernest Hemingway. That's Ernie and Scott.
But I'm not sure.
Yeah.
No, we weren't allowed to. We weren't allowed anywhere near the writers, but we were always told it's because of TNG that they were asking for changes all the time.
No, it changed about 10 years ago that the writers are now on the set of the show. It's I think it's industry wide.
They should be. Yeah. Ira has a confession.
I was always on my shows from mid-90s, so maybe it was a broadcast.
Maybe it's longer than.
I know is this one of the issues on the WGA strike? They wanted to make sure. You know, so I'm glad. Yeah, it makes sense to have a writer there because sometimes you need to change something or whatever.
It's really helpful when you could go, I don't understand.
Well, exactly. Yeah. It makes sense to have one of the writers of the episode there.
And, that's right. Because Kitty's right. You get a script. You have less than 48 hours to think about it before the first day of shooting, at least on our show. And you go, I think that's what they want me to do here or what they're doing. It would have been great to have someone who was a writer to tell me, okay, this is what we were thinking when we wrote this.
Exactly.
Yeah. And here's what's coming next. And here's what we're,
here's what we thought. And here's what we thought the character might be thinking. And don't forget, this is coming. You don't know this yet, but all that is essential. Right. And just as essential, I think, is the writer's or is the actor's responsibility to give the script the way it's written.
The writer is the primary artist. The writer is the primary artist.
The writer's been with it for months and months and months. You have to do it the way it's written.
Right.
And then, go ahead.
I feel like, Armin, you really, because of this, you ended up defining what Ferengi were. Because I think they followed your lead a lot.
You defined Ferengi. I don't want to have that on my tombstone.
Well, you helped redefine the Ferengi. I mean, because as we were talking about before, there's this thing of like the Ferengi can come off as buffoons, or they could come off as despicable, or they could come off as just
one
funny.
Dimensional.
You know, keep going, Anthony.
But you got the nuance just right between there is a little bit of menace, but there's this, I don't know, it was so perfect. And I feel like as the seasons went on, like Robert Hewitt Wolf and guys like that were following your lead and saying, oh, okay, this is what the Ferengi are. And I think it really worked.
Right. Is Ferengi both a noun and a verb?
It is now. There is no plural. No. It's both singular and plural. Ferengi is one, and Ferengi is two.
Yes, so Ferengi. That's what I was going to say. He said worm could be is.
Yeah,
they're everywhere.
Thank you for that. That's very kind. It was always a push pull sort of situation. The writers had an intention, and they did, I think, ameliorate that intention as the years went by. Juan Carlos will be able to tell you better than I. You start to watch dailies. You start to see what actors are doing. Yep. You start to write to that.
Yeah.
Well, there's a certain alchemy in terms of making TV. And so it seems to me that it's also very beneficial for the writers to work with the actors who start to understand the character and then can offer things that maybe because the writer isn't experiencing that, some other aspects to
what's the same way, the same way Jonathan Armin were saying, we're the primary artist. That's very nice of you to say, but it's also a team sport, as what I always say, right? And a great actor is going to bring a character to life in ways you don't even imagine. And you have to be willing to sort of accept that and incorporate it into the character, right? And into the part and into the work. And so, yes, watching dailies, watching cuts, watching, things work, some things don't. And, you find the strengths and you work to those strengths,
I do a lot of theater. And when you do, we're all theater actors, but Star Trek has a lot of theater actors. But when you do a new play, the writers, you're working hand in hand to create the character. It's most of the time you're working hand in hand. It's a wonderful, exciting way to work.
And it was detrimental that we didn't have the writers for 3 years. Yeah. We didn't know what was coming. That's obvious. But we also would have loved to have had the input about what they thought of the characters. I remember twice a year for 7 years, I would take the writers out to lunch after I met them. So it wasn't for 7 years. It was only for 4 years. But I would take them out to lunch and say, just tell me, what's his IQ? Just tell me what his IQ is. I really want to know.
He always seemed to be the smartest. Often he seemed like the smartest guy.
Yeah.
Although
compared to Rom, it wasn't hard. It wasn't hard. But not Max, but Rom.
Armin often says that the Ferengi are the most human of the characters on Deep Space Nine. And I think that's true, too, and partially because Armin had this sense of where the Ferengi could go. That was, we all have bad character traits, but there's,
I thought you were going to say the most revealing thing of all. We all have Ferengi in us.
Yeah,
we do. Well, wasn't that the original intent? They were modern humans because Jonathan and others were playing these evolved humans, these idealized humans.
Well, the original, I've said this many times, forgive me for saying it again, and Johnny knows as well as I do, the Ferengi were originally on TNG supposed to be the new Klingons.
Yeah. Right.
And I fucked that up horribly.
Well, no, she did it better. I wanted you to do it.
That was all in the script, too.
Yeah, you with the whisk.
That was how they wrote it.
Yeah.
Another thing, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention about having the writers in the set. In all fairness, it is not only a gift for all the reasons that have just been expressed, but if an actor is being a real pain in the ass about a scene or a speech, I've been known to say, Juan Carlos, could you talk to him? And then I could carry on with the day. And then you have to listen to his bullshit until the set is lit. And then the actor comes back on the set and does whatever, you know, whatever we've ended up with. But if you stop production to pander to some actors whining about my character would never say this, and you don't have a writer there to help you out or malleable enough actor to say, please do this, is, you know, of course, or you can go back.
And that's where the team sport of it all does come in. But I also sort of train my writers when they go to set to know when to stay out of the way. Mm-hmm. And it is, you have to kind of step back and let the scene come to life and let it's the director's set. It's what I tell the writers, right? You may think you're the running the set, but you're not. It's the director's set. So stay out of the way, let them rehearse and let the questions come to you. And don't talk to the actors unless the director asks you to. That's what I always tell every writer, because you have to have a singularity of vision, right? And that can only come from the director.
But the actors, the directors who collaborate with the actors or with the writers properly, the writers who understand the way the set works will say, here's what I think. And I'll listen and I'll say, well, why don't you share that with the actors? And then I don't have to translate what you've told me. Yeah. And then we can stand together. And then the team is really, and I'm not whispering to someone else what you've whispered to me. And it becomes it's a much more open, but there's on certain sets that doesn't exist, but there's a real nice ebb and flow if everybody is on the same page.
If it works as a team, as Juan Carlos said, if it works as a team, that's the best situation. Yeah. And you get the best work out of it.
Jonathan, we just you were talking about how you directed the fantastic recently Hugo nominated episode of Strange New Worlds, the crossover with Lower Decks. Now, we got the bad news that it was just canceled, or the season 5 is going to be its last season. Mm-hmm. But Alex, I think, said something like, we haven't seen the last of these characters. Every once in a while, we hear rumblings. Do you think there is a chance for crossover 2?
I think the show did so well. Akiva would certainly take the swing like that. And I think Henry Alonso Myers would too. I'm not sure how Paramount Plus or Alex would feel about it, but it worked.
It really did.
Yeah. I wonder, what do you think about Mike Myers and Lower Decks coming up back on Netflix or something?
You mean Mike McMahon?
Mike McMahon, yeah, Mike Myers. Right.
Mike Myers would be a whole different show.
Yeah, I mean, it
would be. Is he doing the Tarantino movie that everybody gets excited about?
Exactly.
wait a minute.
I think it's very different from a business point of view than where they were at with Prodigy. So, you know, I mean, it's a non-zero possibility, but I really don't see that happening, because they would have to, Paramount would probably have to sell them the back library.
Yeah. I got you.
So what I think is more likely to happen is that there's going to be they're going to take another swing at a light, either another animated Star Trek show or a light Star Trek show, maybe even a more comic half hour Star Trek show, even live action, you know. So
God,
you may know more than awesome. I though. I mean, what have you heard?
Yeah. I haven't, but I do know that there's a lot of positive energy around the Michelle Yeoh Section 31 movie. Mm. Yeah. So that 2-hour format now I think is on the table for Star Trek going forward.
Yeah, an animated movie. I mean, I know the Hagemans very much want to do an animated Prodigy movie.
Yeah.
But an animated Lower Decks thing, you know, seems. I mean, Armin, did you have fun?
I had great fun, and I did get to ad lib. Yes. It was a great fun, and they couldn't have been nicer. They were very sweet. And both Nana and I were very touched that they wanted to make it, we thought anyway, to make it a tribute to Deep Space Nine. The opening sequence of shooting the station.
That's great.
Brought tears to both of our eyes because it was just so nostalgic. And we loved working there. It was a great, great experience. It couldn't have been nicer. And I had to take my old teeth out of the cupboard in order to do the voice.
Did you take them to work?
I mean, I took my teeth, I put them in my mouth, and I talked like that.
But they were the ones that Arnice made to you?
Yes, but I used those in the last season. In five shows before we finished the last episode of Deep Space Nine, somebody came into my trailer and stole my teeth.
Oh, if I had a nickel.
Yeah.
Crazy. Wow.
And Mike Westmore had to recreate the teeth ASAP because I had to go to work that day. So, but then what happens is, this is way in the weeds, your teeth move in your mouth over a period of time. So the old teeth didn't fit anymore. So I had to make new teeth.
Jonathan, I know you keep up on various news and this trades. You've seen that they're making another Star Trek movie. There was this weird thing that Patrick Stewart said about getting a movie script a few months ago. Did you read that?
I asked him and, He disremembered, or he said it's something he'd like to do.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'll give you more info when I see him. But somebody, I think Juan Carlos mentioned earlier, I'd love the concept that Tarantino is dancing around Star Trek.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Oh. It would be fun.
Well, he just announced that he's not going to make his final movie that he had announced. So maybe that Star Trek script is back in play again.
The door is open.
And Holly as well from Fargo. I mean, that would have been awesome.
You've seen that script?
No, I'm just saying the idea that those talents were interested in being involved in the, what's that, the Kelvin universe or just in the making of JJ's world?
Well, the Holly thing was a whole new ball of wax. The Tarantino thing as well.
I think the Tarantino thing would have been a mishmash of everything because he didn't care, you know, he wanted.
He actually didn't understand the difference between the two universes.
Wow.
He didn't, and it didn't matter probably. But no, they're making this origin movie prequel thing now and another Kelvin movie. That's kind of their latest at Paramount.
I'm going to jump in about one of the reasons why I thought Terry Metalis was so successful in the last season of Picard is he's a guy who knew the franchise and loved the franchise.
Yeah,
and
like Manny.
One of the things that worries me about some people coming in to run the show is they don't know the franchise and don't really want to know.
Right.
Well, I think Terry's idea of legacy has a shot, as Johnny was talking about the 2-hour movie format. I think if that thing lives, I think that's the most likely home for it, at least as a backdoor pilot. I don't know if you've heard anything about that.
Yeah.
Not a word, but I'm out of the loop, so I haven't heard anything. I know people want it. I've seen enough writing about that. But
I know at least the second choice he'd hire to direct it. If he didn't hire himself, he'd definitely hire you, Jonathan. Don't you think?
He likes to hire himself, though.
But I think he might put you, has he ever talked to you about that idea of doing the movie version of Legacy?
Are you talking about Terry or Alex?
Terry.
Of course he has.
So if Legacy movie happened as a backdoor movie, pilot. Do you think you would be the man behind the camera for that?
I doubt it.
You think Terry would hire himself again?
Oh, yeah.
Like he did for the finale.
Yeah.
Okay. But, well, yeah, fair enough.
I would, too, if I wrote it.
But I bet you he'd hire Armin.
He would hire Armin. Yes.
Thank you. Let's hope he does. Let's hope he does.
I know we're running out of time. Lori, did you have anything?
I do have something I need to tell Jonathan, mm-hmm. which <Uh-oh>. is it's a little strange, but here we go. So the first time I went to the Vegas convention to Star Trek Las Vegas was post-COVID. I was walking around the vendor's room. I only allow myself to buy one item at these things. And they had on sale, as you've joked about so many times, a talking Riker. And all the other talking ones were like $65 and Riker was $15. So I bought Riker. Tony and I got in Tony's car. We bought him batteries. He works great. And that night we're sitting around, we'd rented a big house that year instead of staying at the Rio. And I just was, you know, fooling around with some stuff. I took a picture of the action figure with like some dollar bills and little bottle of booze and some rolling papers and just some dice. And then I laughed for like 20 minutes straight. So ever since then, he has been coming with me pretty much everywhere I go. He's been with celebrities. He's gone to Broadway shows. He sat on Stephen Colbert's desk at the Late Show. Wow. I photographed him with many Star Trek stars and other people. Not standing in the, like, literally just saying, oh, would you do this for once? Sure. Because I know the Discovery cast because of working on After Trek. He's been on canoes in Mohonk and weed shops in Toronto. He's going to France in a couple of weeks. So he has a hashtag, Little Riker, and I post all the pictures on Twitter. And I wanted you to know that he exists. Aww. Here he is. Aww. He's out there. And my dream one day is for the two of you to meet in person.
Oh, we could certainly make that happen.
Little Riker, that's awesome.
It sounds like both like of them Flat Stanley. Up conventions. That's going Stanley Hazard.
Right? He goes everywhere.
He does go everywhere. And I have a sister-in-law who's an artist. Whenever I go to Toronto to visit, she has all these very tiny props. So she'll take him away. Uh-huh. I'll notice he's gone. And then 10 minutes later, my phone starts going crazy with pictures of him with little hats, and little things and props and playing with things. So Mark Altman was like, I need a picture with Little Riker. I got Mike McMahon. I got like all these people. So
I love it.
He's That's been cool. all over Twitter, and there are people who are like, where's Little Riker? I need to know where he is. So I wanted you to know about him.
Maybe in Vegas, Real Riker and Little Riker could meet up.
Yeah, let's make that happen.
That would be awesome. The scientist is just say, with him.
Can I just say, because I have Ferengi and me, I want to plug people. Never mind. I'm not going to go there. So I would love for anybody who could to drop a little money to help people survive pancreatic cancer, go to Purple Stride and find Team Trek Against Pancreatic Cancer and help us out.
www.purplestride.org/Team Trek. And then
in
you
honor
have
of Little Riker.
Who you're going to support, whether it's Franks or Swink or Koto or Billingsley, you have to decide.
Or Shimmerman.
There's that too.
Big Riker.
do that. Go ahead, Kitty.
No, that's it. That's well my friend moment.
We're going to have a link to that up on the site. So people don't Thank have you. To have jotted it down while they were listening. We'll put in any links you guys want. This is a really important cause, and we're really happy that we can help support it.
Thank you so much, guys. Thank you.
Thank you for indulging our silly Star Trek conversation.
Yes, that's
fun. Actually, I've learned a lot by listening. It's really quite interesting.
It's great.
That flew by, guys. That was very nice. Thank you very much. Great. Always good to see you.